You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, Spycast brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about Spycast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you might be listening. We're always looking for ways to make Spycast better, and you can help. So we're joined today by T.D. Barnes, who served as a field engineer at the NASA High Range in Nevada for the X-15, the XB-70, lifting bodies and lunar landing vehicles. He also worked on the NERVA project at Jackson Flats, Nevada, and served in special projects at Area 51. He is the author of multiple books, including a 3-volume book on Area 51 that was made for CIA. And you can find out a whole lot about what he's written and what he's done at his website, td-barnes.com. So, TD, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us here at Spycast.
My pleasure, Vince.
So, when anyone ever has a long career doing intelligence work or things related to intelligence work, I like to ask how they got into it. Because in a lot of respects, there are people that kind of stumble and bumble their way into these jobs and don't realize necessarily that this is going to be a career for them. And then there are those who go into high school knowing that they want to do a certain job. I mean, they're the Kelly Johnsons of the world who could see air at 12 years old. Mm-hmm. And then there are people who just kind of never even heard of the CIA before they had a conversation with them. Where do you fall into that spectrum?
Actually, the CIA knocked on my door while I was in the Army. It was kind of a interesting way it came about. I served an army as Army Intelligence in Korea, and got into electronics, missiles, and radar at Fort Bliss, Texas. Went from one school after another, and spent 2.5 years doing that before going to school, and just one after another. And I became, you might say, top in my field. And the CIA had detected a new radar in Russia. And they're getting ready to build the A-12 that they're going to fly at Area 51. And they needed to know if this radar would enable the Russians to shoot down the A-12 that was going to replace the U-2. The Russians moved the radar to Cuba, and we knew about it. So the CIA and the NSA was flying ghost flights out of Biggs Air Force Base at El Paso. And what they're doing is probing the Russians in Cuba, make them turn on the radar, and they take a look at it, and it answered electronically, and they could make it think it's tracking 10 planes, one plane, coming in, going away, whatever they wanted. And they were able to analyze this radar. And what they determined was, yes, the Russians were advancing fast enough that they would be able to shoot the plane down. And we never flew another flight over Russia.
And this was starting to develop electronic countermeasures also find ways to...
I was very advanced into countermeasures. And the Army was getting ready to deploy the Hawk missile, one to QS, Florida, for the Cuban thing. You know, we hadn't discovered the missiles yet
right.
in Cuba. This was before that. And also one to Europe for the Berlin Wall and the Iron Curtain. And we did not have the ECM, the current ECM that the Russians were using in their MiG-15s. So the CIA approached me to go on a couple of flights in the ghost plane out of Biggs. And we would make the Russians think we had a missile locked on them so they turned on their ECM. And we was how we was able to get the ECM to program our missiles to defend against it.
Right, so you basically were bait.
We flew up in C-97. I flew two missions. My wife did not know about this until recent years. So then went that far from El Paso to Cuba. And, you know, that is jumping off place, and it still is, mm-hmm. for anything in Central America, South America, or Colombia, in place. And so I get up in the morning, leave, and go out there and hop on this ghost plane and take off. It's full of electronics, antennas all over. And once we got what we wanted, of course, they would launch the MiGs. They'd turn on the radar. They scared the death of us. One way to start a war. Mm-hmm. But anyway, we coordinated this with the Air Force at Homestead, and they launched a couple of F-100s. And they get between us and MiGs, and we could haul back.
Right.
Go back.
Yeah. You were going to say haul ass back. Yeah. You can say that. It's okay. We have adults that listen.
So, but that was my first introduction to the program at Area 51. However, I wasn't told that it was Area 51.
Right.
You know, no need to know. But that was my introduction to the CIA. And then they tried to recruit me for all kinds of things. Thereafter, I stayed in contact. And then they... when they actually already start flying the planes at Area 51, they assigned me. I was picked up at NASA on the high range, and one of the seven sisters, the CIA had what they call the seven sisters. Six of them was the Air Defense Command radar sites, and one was my site, mm-hmm. which was 65 miles in Area 51. And every time they had a flight at Area 51 then with an A-12, they would notify us we're going to have something flying today. Monitor it, but don't say anything or don't record it. And I had the only radar that could track physically track the A-12. So when they went through the Mark 1, Mark 2, and Mark 3 stages, they would call me up. We got something you want.
I bet that was interesting. You're like, what's going on here? This is flying slightly faster.
And of course, I knew something was flying at Area 51 because radar was not my job there. I knew radar, but I was actually a technical, I was above that. Mm-hmm. But I was the only one on site that had a clearance.
Right.
I came out of the Army, still had my clearance, and the agency made sure that I kept it. I was their go-to man within NASA on that site. And then I get a call, when you got something we want you to track. We'd lock the doors to the radar room. Tell the radar operator, go take a break. And I track the, whatever they're tracking, and then hand them the velocity chart when we got through.
Was there an understanding at this time that there was a secret program happening in Nevada in somewhere that CIA was running? I mean, the U-2 had been flying for a little while. I mean,
no one really knew about Area 51 then. The everybody knew the facilities out there, but the AEC was a cover mm-hmm. on it, and also NASA.
Right, it was the Nevada test site that was used for nuclear testing.
And it's interesting why they picked Area 51 in Nevada for the U-2, and why they picked the CIA. You know, there was a lot of politics involved. The Air Force, General LeMay just flat refused to build a plane with one engine in it, and that did shoot guns and drop bombs.
Right.
I mean, we need to know what the Russians are doing behind the Iron Curtain. We'd lost over 200 air crew in Russia, the Air Force had. Getting shot down just trying to get a photograph of what's going on. So anyway, so when they decided to locate a site to track or test flight the U-2, they picked Nevada because there's only 237,000 people in the whole state. And then during World War II, all the military services had moved from the West Coast to Nevada, made it the West Coast line of defense during World War II, thinking that the Japanese were going to capture the West Coast. Mm-hmm. So we had the Army, Navy, Marines, and Air Force all in Nevada. So what was one more little installation stuck right out in the middle of all of these? And they didn't make it a big secret about it. They just said it's going to be NASA tracking a high-altitude weather research. Good cover story.
Well, and this is before Las Vegas turned into Las Vegas,
it's just a frontier.
Yeah.
And most people worked for the government back then. Right. You know, the gambling wasn't big or anything like that.
Well, I mean, that's, you know, right next to New Mexico also, where there's a lot of basically government facilities that were top secret there as well.
Less than 5% of the people that ever worked at Area 51 knew the CIA was involved.
Huh.
less than 5%. They had no, they didn't have a need to know.
Right.
My and only the cadre. We were cadre. My group was 23 of us. We were specialists in special project. We could live here. So that was our base. But anyone else, they were the customer, and they couldn't even live in the state of Nevada. They commuted out of mostly out of California. Even your A-12 people, they lived in Burbank in that vicinity.
Right.
And then they'd fly up every Monday morning or whenever on a C-47 or whatever.
Right, and, like the people from Skunk Works and others doing the Lockheed stuff.
Exactly.
So you had to commute to work in a very interesting way also. It's not like there was a superhighway leading to Groom Lake.
No, we went out on Monday morning, and I was kind of special. I flew up to Queen Air, but wife would take me out to the, we had it parked on the end of McCarran. We had a little building there with a chain link fence around it, just didn't, no signs or anything. And we kept the plane inside the building. We'd go out there and we'd push it out by hand, open the gate and push it out, hop aboard, just take off.
So you could avoid traffic because you flew to work every day.
Mm-hmm. We flew. Yeah. And then came home Friday night. We stayed up there all week. And it was, anyone that ever worked up there, they'll tell you it's the best assignment they ever had, even though you used up there, the hardships. But the food was best in the world. There's no food better. I mean, they took care of us.
Yeah. And, well, you would think that, I mean, since the cadre was so small, and I think this is obvious now because you do have, like, Roadrunners International and where mm-hmm. There's a bit of a fraternity of people who worked out there who all kind of went through the same thing together and were clear to the same levels.
Well, and what was interesting, when you got out there, the, you know, like the pilots and all that, they couldn't even come in my building because we was working on other projects.
Right.
And then, and even within my group, we would have different customers, would help each other, and you knew basically what the other was doing. And you're helping them out if you need them, hand them something, but you didn't ask questions. Who are you doing this for, or how's it work,
right.
or... You know, and we still don't. There's some things that we know has not been declassified, and we still don't talk about it.
Well, I mean, you're talking about counterintelligence in this case, but you also have to be worried about things like Soviet satellite reconnaissance and other things. Because this is the most top-secret facility in the United States.
Soviet Union, you was there.
Yeah.
And we called them ashcans. They had launched satellites. Of course, there wasn't that many satellites in those days.
Yeah.
But we'd get a roster... security give it to us in the morning. Here's what they launched last night. Here's what's coming over. And we knew the times. And we would, if it's RF seeking, and we shut down all emissions, or if it's infrared, we would have to move everything off the outside, move it in a hoot-scoot shed or hangar or something like that.
So, you know, maybe people would push an A-12 inside of a hangar if they knew the satellite was going over the top.
Exactly. And it's really a pain because we were doing... You know, stealth was, CIA was really into stealth. The A-12 was the first stealth plane.
Mm-hmm.
And we had it on the pole with a pylon for 16 months.
Maybe you radar cross-section testing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the and every time satellites coming over, if it was infrared, we would have to move take the plane off the pole, hide it. And we didn't find out many, many years later that when the Russians started declassifying stuff, they knew the exact shape of that plane all along because it left a shadow on the lake bed, and the infrared picked up the shadow of it. They knew the exact shape of it.
Well, I imagine if you've got a 110-degree day,
mm-hmm.
that shadow would be at least 15, 20 degrees different.
Exactly.
You're certainly going to get different thermal signature from that.
Exactly. So they knew the exact shape of it. They knew what it was doing, even though they didn't physically get to see the... see the plane.
Well, it didn't help them figure out how to shoot it down.
No.
The A-12 and its sister plane, the SR-71, just extraordinary. I did a podcast with, I don't know, Buzz Carpenter, who was an SR-71 pilot.
Yeah.
They talked about the countermeasures to being fired at. It wasn't to maneuver. It wasn't to launch flares. It was to speed up.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
It was basically...
Outrun the missiles.
Yep.
Yeah, we flew during Black Shield. We flew 26 missions over North Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. And they would shoot missiles at us. And sometimes they would shoot past the plane and then actually lock onto it and catch up with it. When the proximity fuse went off, the plane was going so fast it outrun the explosion. And the only Blackbird, including the SR-71 that ever got hit with a missile, was Dennis Sullivan in an A-12. He landed it at Kadena. And they found a little piece of shrapnel embedded in the plane. They got it at CIA headquarters now. That's the only missile that ever, piece of missile that ever struck the Blackbird.
And it's extraordinary because the engineering of this aircraft was so ahead of its time. And the fact that very few of them were lost, I mean, one of them was lost to the tag board trials where the drone basically threw through the back of the aircraft.
Exactly, yes.
How close, because actually a co-pilot was lost in that, died in that actual...
Ray Torque.
Yeah, Bill Park was a pilot.
The M-21, most of the M-21,
right. D-21. And the D-21 was the tag board.
Yeah.
That had to have been, I mean, again, this fraternity of just these people who were very few and who spent a lot of time together, Monday through Friday, right? Mm-hmm. The kind of camaraderie that was created at this must have been extraordinary.
My group, we either had a cruiser on Lake Mead, we had a cabin on Mount Charleston, and that's something we had in common, and we could plan and talk all week, and then we spent the entire weekend on the lake, my group did. Mm-hmm. We take the families out there, the wives made sure there's no honeydew stuff for us to do, they had all the chores done, mm-hmm. So we'd immediately head for the lake. But what is very, very interesting is there was no divorces. Absolutely no divorces.
Well, what's interesting is you mentioned this also on your website, that unlike a lot of these secret projects that CIA did, where they were looking for single men and for people that didn't have a familiar tie and didn't have any mm-hmm. kind of... They actually recruited you because you were married, because you had kids, exactly. Because they understood the family home environment was stable and it was something that would, I guess, you'd be more psychologically adept to doing these kinds of operations.
Yeah, you know, single guys are like Tom Cruise and Top Gun.
Yeah.
You know, and we didn't need that.
Right, well, and that's the one really interesting thing also about not only the engineers, the pilots, everybody, everyone's kind of nondescript, right? It's not like mm-hmm. no one's walking in with the call sign Maverick, right? They're just normal guys who, I mean, Bill Park's a great example of this, right? This guy is just, if you saw him on the street, you would not say he had flown
some
of the most amazing aircraft ever made and crashed half of them because he was a test pilot.
Well, Bill Park had more silk time than anyone I know. Another was interesting one was Jack Layton that flew the 812. Agency pilot, he jumped out of three different planes that was on fire, and one of them landed in the Everglades, spent the night with the alligators and rattlesnakes. Another was in the Pacific, to call him out for the Coast Guard to find him, and then the third one was the YF-12 caught on fire at Edwards, and we actually got a video of it the entire flight. They had a camera at Edwards that was able to track that plane. You see the engine on fire. And of course, the pilots are talking. They cleared the area, and then when it burnt through the hydraulics, so Jack and his RSO had to jump out, and just by coincidence, you know, the camera's still on the plane. Both parachutes goes right through the frame as they're coming down.
You couldn't have planned that if you
couldn't
wanted
have planned
to,
it.
Right?
Absolutely not.
Well, as an engineer, as somebody who's kind of, you know, obviously loves building, it had to have been. There's no better place on earth for high-tech, cutting-edge engineering than Area 51 at this time?
Area 51, to me, of course, coming off the NASA high range, Area 51 was very boring.
Okay.
Because the NASA high range, we've been doing the S-15, the SB-70, right. The YF-12, the A-12 occasionally, and every day was, and these were nail-biters, the S-15, we weren't testing planes, it was a workhorse.
Right.
And everything that went to the moon in Apollo, we tried it first in the S-15. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. And so it was a very dynamic work schedule. And we got out to the area, and particularly when we started doing stealth, at your arch guard, they'd bring a prototype out for us to look at, the RCS on, radar cross-section on. And we may not hear from them for another 3 months. Mm-hmm. And we were there, out there all week. So we had a lot of engineers, a lot of, you know, all of us were energetic and let's do something. So we did a lot of projects that were not on the books, that later became projects just because we had the knowledge, we had the toys to play with. Because we put everything we get, we put it on the pole.
Right.
And this is a funny story. We had the Nellis Gunny Range surrounds Area 51. This is just a big no-fly zone. And on their maps, it's a big square. They called it the box, the right. Air Force guys. They said a lot of names, but that's what they called it. So we had one day, a young pilot, he decided he'd land on that long airstrip. You know, they could all see it down there. And he landed, and nothing happened, really. And he got back and said, boy, that's neat. You ought to see that place. So another one landed, F-105. We kept the We kept the pilot for 2 weeks, debriefing him, but we would let Nellis have their plane back. And we actually put it on the pole, on the pylon, and sent a photograph. Nellis, here's your plane. And that stopped the emergency flights.
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah.
But we, that's what we started doing is we, you know, when we did the MiGs, we put the MiGs on the
right.
On
I was going to ask you about that because it wasn't just looking at our aircraft. It was
no, we started anything we got our hands on. We realized that every plane gave a different radar signature, and that really became a project. It came out of boredom. Hey, let's put that thing on post. Well, there's like, so we had time on our hands.
Yeah, because you did everything from the MiG-21, the MiG-17. These were premier Soviet fighter aircraft in Vietnam and even beyond that. I can't imagine how good the intelligence from understanding these aircraft from an electronic intelligence point of view.
The kill ratio in Vietnam at the time was 9-1 against us. And the Russians came out with the new MiG-21 fish bed. And we thought it was the plane. And, of course, an Iraqi defected to Israel with a brand new MiG-21. We got our hands on it in January 1968. And the first thing we did was tore it down, see how they built it, did a technical evaluation of it, and then we flew it. And on the first try, the Navy came in. The Navy was more interested in the Air Force, even though the Air Force was running the flight dynamic, I mean, the Forward Technology Division out of Wright-Patterson was heading up the testing part of it. And the Navy was losing more planes. But they came in and flew against the MiG-21, and on the first flight, we got a 100% kill against the Navy. Within 2 months, they started Top Gun. They realized it's not the planes. It's just our people that don't know how to fight.
Right.
And what we realized, if it take a pilot in Vietnam probably 10 missions before he learned enough about the way they fought and the planes that he might survive the war. We decided, let's give those pilots 10 missions in Nevada rather than Vietnam. And that's exactly what we did. And then the Air Force started the red flag exercise.
Right, which is right here.
Yeah. And then we actually established a squadron of MiGs at Tonopah where they could fly against the real thing. And the guys at Tonopah would actually play the Russian national anthem so they would fight like a Russian rather than America,
right.
You know, expose you guys to the real thing. And we'd actually send people off to Samoa. It was one of our training places. They were trained by the Russians, and they'd fly the Russian MiG-21s. And they got crossways with the Russians, so we'd go in, and our pilots actually flew with them and learned the tactics that they had been trained to fight like a Russian.
Right, which is very different. I mean, in the Army, we have the National Training Center where we dress up American vehicles to look like Russian ones. Exactly. They certainly do the same tactics. Top Gun, they take American aircraft that have, or Allied aircraft that have similar characteristics, perhaps. But Tonopah is literally, these are MiG-21s, right? These are Russian aircraft, the real thing.
The real thing. We had two MiG-17s that we got. We got a lot of stuff from Israel during the Six-Day War. They captured on the battlefield. And that's where we got a lot of our radar. That's one of my specialties, was Soviet radar. We got them. We needed, as we were developing stealth, we need to know what the Russians were going to see. So we had to use their equipment to look at what we were doing.
Right.
So we got our hands on a lot of the Soviet radar. And a couple of Syrians landed on the wrong airstrip during the Six-Day War. So that's how we got our hands on the MiG-17s.
Well, I mean, it's a lot more than just understanding their radar because of fighting them. It's also understanding their radar because of actually manufacturing new aircraft and kind of tactics. I mean, I remember the story, the B-1 was developed to fly in low because we found out later on that the Russian look-down radar was essentially non-existent. It was crap.
Yeah.
And so that kind of intelligence coming in not only helps us fight a war, but it also helps us to develop and procure and create new tactics and everything else, how important that is for fighting.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting is the DIA was almost as involved as CIA was, or maybe more so. Mm-hmm. There's a different role. They dealt with the countries. In fact, they're the ones that made the deal with Israel for the MiGs and that sort of thing. They're just now starting to declassify all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was a CIA facility, but the DIA was the one that brought them in, and the Air Force managed the scheduling and the flights and that sort of thing, them and the Navy. So it was a group effort.
Did you, there's a very famous story about the CIA sort of disinformation campaign about keeping Area 51 secret. I'm not going to talk about aliens, don't worry.
Yeah.
But the concept of kind of letting that stupidity go instead of stepping in and saying no, 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 was pretty ingenious.
It was.
The idea of let people chase flying saucers because then they won't be looking for the X.
They look ridiculous, and then if they really see something, they're not. No one's going to believe them anyway.
Right. Did you understand when you were there that kind of the mystique of Area 51 or what it would become, kind of that?
Not really. I think that most of us out there had worked on classified projects before. And it was just something, we were real proud to be doing what we knew was doing a lot of good. We regret now we didn't take photographs. Of course, we couldn't at the area, but even out at the lake, we just didn't take photographs and that sort of thing. In fact, I'll tell you, while I was on the NASA High Range, one of the F-15 flights, the engine didn't ignite. He had land on Mud Lake up at Tonopah. So they went in and got the F-15, put it on a flatbed, and got us toward Beatty, where we were living, where the radar site was. It was late Friday, and the trucks are not allowed to cross Death Valley on weekends. So the truck sit in my driveway all weekend with the X-15 on it. I didn't take a single photo of the X-15 sitting in my driveway.
In your driveway.
We just didn't think about it. It wasn't a big deal.
Right. Well, hindsight is 20/20, right? You look back and like, man, I should have taken a picture of that.
I just like the radar site at Beatty. Spent years there. I don't have a single photograph I took of that. Of me in it or any of the people. We got some that NASA took, but we don't have our own photographs.
Did you work closely with the engineers who actually were creating these aircraft? Like, was there a conversation with, like, when you did the radar cross section for the A-12? Did you go back to Kelly Johnson and team and be like, here's what it looked like and here's how you?
Yes. They had, in fact, we did all the data processing on it and. Not only the radar, but the data and everything, yes.
Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
How much of a collaborative process was that? I mean, it seemed like it was somewhat siloed.
It wasn't much. Now, you didn't really... Just certain people could talk to each other.
Right.
And I'm not even sure who talked to the engineer that wasn't me.
Yeah.
That did that. I think probably it was Jim Friedman. This is because no one knew exactly what we all did.
Right.
Even though we were there, you did things in your own little room. But Jim Friedman, and this is kind of funny when they were just a few years ago, I think it was Danny Jacobs was interviewing Colonel Slater, the commander, and Jim was mentioning that he was the one that would pick up the CIA dispatches from Langley out at McCarran. I think it was Frontier Airlines was bringing them in. And then the evening, then he would go by Warner Weiss's office, the CIA commander, and pick up the dispatches going back. Slater had no idea, and him and Warner were just as close as brothers. Hmm. He had no idea that someone was picking up the dispatches and going back and forth. He just didn't have a need to know.
Well, it's a question about how much did you know? You mentioned that people didn't know CIA was necessarily involved, and certain people didn't. Were you fully cognizant that CIA was your customer?
I was.
Okay.
Yeah.
But that was because you were part of the cadre. But everyone else wasn't necessarily.
No. Because I'd worked for them before. There was five of us that were special. They kept, and we were the ones that flew in the Queen Air. Mm-hmm. And CIA went. You know, when they formed the Science Technology Division in 1962, at the time they weren't really that active. Hadn't made a business out of Area 51. It was just A-12. But by 1968, they saw that they were into stealth. The CIA said, "We're going to continue after Archcard. It's gone. Mm-hmm. We're going to stay here." And they stayed for another 10 years. And a lot of people wondered how they'd been doing for 10 years that no one knew about. But we were doing the stealth and things like that.
Was that working on some of the HabBlue stuff?
HabBlue.
Becomes the F-117.
All kind of We did a lot of prototypes that never sold a lot of day. They were strictly technology demonstrators, just to see how they'd work.
How much of that was to try to develop American technology, and how much of it was that try to prepare ourselves for what other countries might be developing?
Take the Talking Radar, for example, that I talked about in Cuba. Well, we immediately built our own Talking Radar so that we didn't have to fly the A-12 over Cuba or someplace to see if our ECM and whatever was working. Well, that became a practice out there, and it became a laboratory. The CIA made it into a laboratory where someone come out with something new. Say, Texas Instrument came out with a pod to go on B-52 for some purpose. Well, they didn't, against something in China or Russia, where, well, they didn't have to fly to a foreign country to test it. They flew to Area 51, and they fly over. And that was just, you know, we had everything there. That became, we actually became a business. Mm-hmm. And we actually called them customers. Anyone outside of our group was a customer. Even the CIA could be a customer if they came in with something that was off the wall.
Right, we skipped over this. It was important that you worked for a contractor.
Yeah.
Now, you weren't a CIA employee necessarily. No. This is all through a contractor, just the same way the Nevada nuclear test site mm-hmm. is run by contractors. So you work for one as well.
Yeah, everyone was classified as working for the CIA for a reason. Nevada had a state law that any contractors working in the state over 30 days or something had to get a card, work card for their employees mm-hmm. and that sort of thing, because of gambling and all that.
Right.
So the way they got around it, they said everybody works for the CIA, works for the government. So we hid under that umbrella. But we reported directly to the CIA.
Right.
We did not report any of the company people, the company boss. We worked for EG&G. We didn't report to EG&G management. We reported directly to whoever was assigned to us in CIA.
Right. Even though EG&G is one of the most highly cleared contractors, mm-hmm. I mean, they were involved in every single program, especially a lot of the early nuclear stuff. So they certainly had the clearance. But this is as need to know as it gets.
The need to know, and then 1968, when they started moving out the A-12, Oshkard, and they cut down all the forces they had there. The CIA at that point told the EG&G, "We don't want any more of your test site people. We want to pick our own people. We're going to have, they'll still be working for you, but we're going to recruit them." Mm-hmm. So that's another thing a lot of people don't know. The CIA didn't, when they were recruiting for Oshkart in particular, they didn't trust the FBI enough to let them do the security clearances. They did their own clearances. And
which is rare. I mean, even for case officers, they use the FBI or OPA.
But they did not, but you know, the U-2 program, the Aquatone, was more highly classified than the Manhattan Project. Mm-hmm. Another thing came up, and this is real recent, in last August, one of the U-2 pilots, Tony Bravacra, and I were invited back to the Defense Intelligence Agency to sit on a panel Well, he was Air Force. We trained him at Area 51 on the U-2, but he was Air Force. He never flew for CIA. So during the course of the panel, he talked about how he got recruited. I sit there listening. It was so different from the CIA. And one thing they had in common is all the pilots had been F-84 pilots at Turner Air Force Base. And all of a sudden, Gary Powers actually bunked with Tony. Mm-hmm. One day, Gary wasn't there anymore. And they started disappearing. And then Tony got, when he arrived at Area 51, he found out where they were.
Right.
Here they were. And they couldn't talk to him. So they were CIA by this time.
Oh.
And they couldn't talk to him. But anyway, so when he got through, I mentioned about how they selected the CIA pilot. I said, you know, their cover was high altitude weather testing for NASA. But actually, almost all of the first class were already flying out the Nevada test site. They fly in the F-84s through the atomic bomb test. Mm-hmm. Tony had never heard of that. So then he run it by Major General Pat Halloran, their friend of ours, that also flew the F-84s. He'd never heard of it. They had never heard about their fellow pilots that they bunked with at Turner was flying through a atomic bomb test. But that's something we had in common with the atomic bomb program was our pilots flew out there.
Right. Well, I mean, again, geographically, people on the East Coast or otherwhere don't understand the geography of Nevada. It's Groom Lake and the Nevada test site are essentially, you can accidentally go from one to the other. You don't know if you're on one or the other. It's basically just desert. So, yeah, there probably was a lot of overlap there. That had to have been somewhat bittersweet when Oxcart was rolled up. I know that you went on and did a lot of work afterwards with that. But just as far as an engineering kind of just, it's,
yeah,
there's no, I mean, the aircraft is just so, it's perfection.
It was. And one of my things, they brought me out there. They were trying to get, this was not part of Oxcart, but they were using the Oxcart vehicle before they left to get Mach 3 RCS. With the flying over, with the radar. Well, they'd had a heck of a time. You know, if they didn't pick up that plane and it's on the horizon, it'd be coming in so fast that the radar couldn't physically slew fast enough in altitude
right.
to ever capture it, you know. Well, they, of course, I was used to tracking missiles while I was in the Army, and then I tracked thousands of them out of White Sands, which are fast, and then I was on the X-15, which was almost Mark 7, twice as fast as the A-12. Mm-hmm. So they rushed me out there and brought in, we went to McGregor Range down by El Paso and picked up one of my Nike radars that I had trained in the Army and brought it out there. That became our primary radar. And so we managed to get some Mark 3 radar cross-sections. But that was for the benefit of stealth. The CIA was already looking ahead. That wasn't even part of Oxcart. Mm-hmm. They just used, there's an opportunity. Let's get it while we can.
How much of working on stealth was to try to develop countermeasures to other countries working on stealth? I mean,
we didn't do much of that.
No. We were so far ahead of everybody else. We were in technology.
What's funny is that, you know, the stealth technique came from Russia.
Yeah.
You know,
Well, so did a lot of the titanium.
Yeah, the titanium, the actual, A-12. For the A-12.
Which is a fantastic story if you get a chance that all the front companies that were created to buy titanium from the Soviets to build the A-12 and the SR-71. Was there a moment at Area 51 or even at the Nevada High Range where you kind of just stopped and said you were amazed, or it was just like, I know... You kind of got a little bit jaded, might be the wrong word, where just kind of seen so much stuff, it became kind of ho-hum. Like you said, Area 51 is boring, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of people out there are going to be like, Area 51 is boring. But was there a time where your jaw just dropped, where you just could not believe, that you can talk about, mm-hmm. that you could not kind of believe what you were seeing?
It did. Particularly with the stealth. That was a very interesting project. You know, we went through a lot of trial and error. We got it where the radar looking at the plane couldn't see it,
yeah.
but it's reflecting it. It'd be, you have radar here on another hill or something, it's picking up the signal.
Right.
So we had to address all those sort of things, you know. And so that was quite a challenge to come up with a true stealth plane. And we made the A-12 about About 90% stealth.
Well, it helps when it flies as fast as it does, also.
Yeah, and speed. Well, right. There's no way. It carried 80,000 pounds of fuel. There's no way you'd hide 80,000 pounds of fuel from radar.
Well, and you're not going to.
And then temperature.
Right, thermal. You're not going to be able to hide
thermal, you know. Yeah. The temperature flew actually, you know, around the air intake, it gets as high as 2,200 degrees. Windshield 800. And it was a hot plane.
Right. How much did you cross purpose with what NASA was doing? Or was it completely siloed?
No, we really worked together with NASA quite a bit, the designers, because we were doing the XB-70, which was a Mach 3 plane also, a bomber.
Mm-hmm. And is that the Valkyrie?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it used a honeycomb type skin, whereas Lockheed was using the titanium. And they compared a lot of notes and on the engines and just a lot of comparison back and forth between North America and Lockheed on that as they developed that.
It's amazing there's some of these gorgeous aircraft that never really see the light of day. I mean, the XB-70 is a great example of this. We're just... Some engineer somewhere was able to design some of the prettiest aircraft ever made. They just didn't necessarily fly as well as they should.
I love that XB-70 program. I was on it from the first flight, and that was kind of a funny story. It was kind of a joint NASA Air Force project, but NASA, I mean, the Air Force wouldn't give NASA the beacon code when it first started flying. And so we had to skin track it. Well, as far as Beatty, unless he got very high, we didn't have a good skin track. They track him at Edwards, but not uprange. And we kept trying to get a lot of jealousy between NASA and the Air Force on that. But the Air Force was having a problem with their radar. They couldn't maintain lock for some reason. It's just they're going through all kind of difficulties with it. Well, my radar operator at Beatty had worked at the Cape, and that's where our Mod 2 radar had come from. We used very antique radar, by the way. And one day was at the bar at the Shank Club there at Beatty after a flight, and he banged down on the bar, and he said, "I remember the code." He said, "Air Force is notorious for never changing their code." So next day, we was having a mission, that should be 70. So Bill... tuned in that code to the beacon, and we even with the B-70 sitting on the ground at Edwards, it triggered the beacon just like it almost saturates your receiver.
Right.
It is a big beacon, and he got it, and he said, "Shall I?" We notify Edwards we got track, and we said, "No, just wait a while." So Air Force just fumbling along, and And they're going to have to abort the mission, so we decided to give Bill to go ahead. And he announced on the intercom, went all everywhere. Beatty radar, full auto track, 001, which the plane was flying. And I mean, the airway just got just as quiet as could be. And then the Norm Hayes down at Edwards, he said, "Beatty, you got radar track?" "Firmly, sir. We're tracking." So we went ahead, sole radar. We did the mission. Only one radar track, and that's ours at Beatty. We fired that beacon because the Air Force kept dropping off and everything. And I think it was about two missions later, they took off at Palmdale and landed at Dryden. NASA took over from the Air Force. Mm. But it was shy fun for the Air Force, just wouldn't share with us.
I mean, I can understand the need for security and compartmentalization, but these are all overlapping programs.
Yeah.
CIA, NASA, Air Force.
It's always been that way. It's such a shame, so much money wasted hiding technology. And it's the same way with your intelligence.
Right.
You know, Truman everybody hated the CIA, or OSI. They dissolved all the intelligence.
Right.
A month after World War II ended.
Right, OSS was dissolved. Yeah.
And it's always been a struggle.
Yeah, I mean, but looking at... especially going to the 1960s when it became so absolutely fundamental to know what was happening inside the Soviet Union, and it really was overhead reconnaissance and geospatial intelligence that was going to be the solution to this because our human intelligence assets were non-existent. It's sad, though, that there was still this kind of compartmentalization of information and parochialism within these different organizations.
The battles that went on between CIA and Air Force behind the scenes over the U-2. It's just amazing. And it reminds me of General Gibbs. He was Dick Bissell's right-hand man, his deputy. And it ruined his military career. After he went back into the Air Force, they wouldn't have anything to do with him. And, you know, he never made another star. And another was Doug Nelson. He was a colonel at the time, and LeMay sent him to March Air Force Base to spy on the U-2 program when it started. But Doug liked the U-2 program, and he became got where he wouldn't report back to LeMay.
Which is if you think about it logically, and I know we're looking at it in hindsight, but LeMay's Strategic Air Command depended on knowing where Soviet strategic missiles were.
Mm-hmm.
And the U-2 was providing that information. So LeMay should love the U-2 because it's allowing him to develop targeting packages for mm-hmm. everything. And yet it's this parochialism, this kind of they're getting more money than we are for things that we should be doing. That caused it. I wonder what would have happened. Again, this is kind of a counterfactual. What would have happened if people had worked together at this point, and how
exactly
the redundancy we would have avoided, the money we would have saved.
You know what was interesting too? You know, we're talking about the Cuban thing when we detected evaluating the talking. Mm-hmm. Well, we detected that they had this radar in the first place. It's reflections off of ICBMs being flown inside of Russia. So after we got through with the Cuban thing, we actually put a big antenna right outside of Morgantown, New Jersey, right off the turnpike, aimed it at the moon. And just a matter of weeks, we had pinpointed every radar site in Russia, just from reflections off the moon.
Well, that's interesting. This is a great. Yeah, you're too young maybe to have worked on BMUs.
Yeah.
Where when they fired that thing up, they thought we were under full attack because they picked up the moon rising over the horizon. It's wonderful to hear those almost, not almost disasters, but those early engineering mess-ups, because mm-hmm. we learn so much from mistakes. And I think that's really what kind of Area 51 was designed to do, was to learn from, to have a place to screw up.
Yeah.
And to have the money to screw up and the freedom to screw up.
We had a lot of what we call OS moments.
Yeah.
And a little funny thing, when we doing the MiG-21, after we had put it back together, and before we flew it, we wanted to do an evaluation of the engine. The engine had 125 hours on it, brand new engine. And, well, by Russian standards, it was, you know, because it was a throwaway. Mm-hmm. You know, they didn't rebuild them like we do. But anyway, we tied the plane down for the military power. The brakes wouldn't really hold it with that engine at full power, you know. So we tied it down, and we was going to start our engine test. Everybody and their dog wants to watch this MiG-21 test. And someone noticed their film badges. You know, we carried on our security badges. We carried dosimeters mm-hmm. and film badges. These are loaded with junk. Someone said, hey, we better gather up these film badges. Someone was liable to get their badge searched through the engine. So we gathered up all the film badges, about 25 of them. And I always like to tell them, we gave it to Gomer Powell. That old engine's just sitting there screaming, you know, and then the old plane's a tugging, and Gomer gets right up in front of it. Golly! He sucked every one of our badges through the engine. We hadn't even got to fly the plane yet. And we had to have it back to Israel in 2 months because they were going to use it for some kind of celebration back there. And fortunately, some of the Pratt Whitney guys built the J-58 for the Blackbirds was still on the site. And they tore it down and polished out the dings and stuff and got it flyable again. But that's one of those moments, oh, God, what have we done?
Well, I remember that one of the first, and this is, again, probably before you were there. It was way before you were there. It was the U-2 pilot. But they just did a taxi test for the U-2, and it took off by accident.
Yeah.
And that's, again, that's where Area 51 allows you to do these things that you can't do anywhere else, because you're there to screw up, really. I mean, that's you're learning from the mistakes, and that's what you want to try to do.
Hank Meyer, who was one of the IP out there for the U-2, was one of my best friends. And he'd talk about how they would go up, and every flight they broke the world's altitude record and couldn't tell anyone. Mm-hmm. But they didn't have any manuals at that time, no dash ones, and they didn't have any simulators. So they'd try stuff, and they'd come back in and say, man, don't try this. It'll get you killed, you know.
Yeah.
And they wrote the books. But you got to admire those pilots. They all the pilots that flew different things at Area 51. A Bird of Prey, the Tackett Blue, you know, the proof of concept planes that, yeah. I wonder if this thing will fly. Let's find out. And they hop aboard and here they go, you know.
Was it the test pilots there and at Edwards were basically, their job was to do things no one else ever done before and to see if it worked or it killed them.
Yeah, Joe Walker was one of my best friends. You know, got killed in the midair with the with the Valkyrie. There's B-70. Yeah, and I got to tell you a story that might be of interest. When I got the Beta radar, a Beta tracker station, I noticed on, you know, we plotted the course and altitude and everything, or the whatever was flying, mainly the X-15, on a X-5 plotter, big old plotter. And you had three radar sites. You had one at Edwards, you had one at Beatty, one at Ely. And it's all ganged together. And whichever one was providing the best data is one that they would use as the primary. Well, anytime that would switch over from Edwards, switch over to Beatty, or switch to Ely or whatever, there was a 2,000-foot jump in altitude. So it concerned me, and I noticed that Beatty radar always agreed with altitude being reported by the B-52 and the F-15. Right to the foot. But the other two always had this little jump. So I mentioned it to Edwards one day. I said, you know, we got a problem here. I'm seeing a 2,000-foot jump in altitude on all these flights. And the operator down there said, well, that's the inherent problem. We've always had that. It just ignore it. Well, I'm in there at hell. Because you know, I see when Edwards would lock on the beef anything sitting on the ground, tarmac at Edwards, it's short of 2,000 feet.
Right, which is problematic when you're low to the ground.
So,
right?
One day, they the number three bird was going to overhaul, and the B-70 wasn't going to be flying. We had about a week or so of downtime. So I just got on the horn, and our communications went to White Sands, went to Vandenberg, it went everywhere. And so I got on there, and I called up my counterpart at Edwards, and I said, you know, we got some downtime. It's a good time for us to fix your and Ely's radar problems. The boy got quiet. And he tried to shut me off. And each side had a NASA employee as a monitor. Mm-hmm. We worked on incentive-type projects. So, you know, and he stepped out, and he gave me the thumbs up. You know, he knew what I was going to do. And then I said, John, I said, no, it's not an inherent, there's no such thing as an inherent problem in radar. I said, you've got a 2,000-foot error in your and Ely's radar, and you can't tell a pilot when he's within 2,000 foot of the ground. I said, you're going to kill someone.
Yeah.
He tried to shut me up, and he said, well, it's Beatty's radar problem. And I said, no, it's not. He said, well, mine and Ely's agree. I said, that doesn't make any difference. You're 2,000 foot off. Beatty is the only radar that's working right.
Right, but the radar was the same as when the aircraft, right?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So he tried to shut me up, and this was going into the pilot's room. Joe Walker was in the pilot's lounge. And when he tried to shut me off on it, Joe got on there, and he said, effective immediately, there'll be no more flights on the NASA high range until this is fixed. So they worked for about 2 weeks. They tore the radar down. They put them back together, probably. They finally found what it was a field engineering modification that came out in the 1940s, where actually built a radar, and they had applied it to the one in the at Beatty, but the other two radars had never got modified.
So it had been 2 decades, and they hadn't been modified.
This time. But they fixed them.
Yeah.
And of course, I became station manager, and the company got a big bonus. For that quarter, because the way we worked on NASA range, the contractor was given X number of dollars for each quarter. And then every time you screwed up, and this could be anything, like not going to the cheapest vendor for your tires for the trucks or a vehicle, anything, they'd do knock it off, you know.
Yeah.
And you'd actually end up owing.
Yeah.
So that's the type of contract we worked under, and so we got a big bonus set. Because of that.
When you probably saved some lives at Edwards. I mean,
I would think so, yeah.
Because, I mean, the proverbial envelope, I mean, they pushed every limit you possibly could, and I can imagine 2,000 foot difference in the radar is problematic.
It was funny though. The site manager, when I didn't even check it with him because I knew he was too weak to ever address anything like that. And boy, he whirled around. He was in the same room with me. He just glared and he said, "You're on your own." But the NASA guy came out and gave me the thumbs up. I knew I was on solid ground because I was right.
Right. And it was a safety issue more than anything. Yeah. Well, T.D. Barnes is the president of the Roadrunners International. He is an author, a prolific one, and you can find a lot of what he's written on multiple websites, but the one that has some great information is td-barnes.com. There's also a much longer website, area51specialprojects.com/barnes/area51, which gives a lot of the story that we just talked about in a written form. So, T.D., thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us here at SpyCast. We truly appreciate it.
It's fun. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to SpyCast. Remember, every Tuesday we will post a new podcast available from both spymuseum.org and iTunes. If you have any questions or comments about SpyCast, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org or leave a comment or review on our iTunes page. You can also follow us on Twitter at @INTLSpycast. That's @INTLSpycast. Talk to you next week.